Welcome to Bibliophiles, a production of the Center for Lit podcast network. In today's episode, the Center for Lit team continues its quest to discover the great ideas in books of every description, ancient classics to new bestsellers, epic poems to bedtime stories. We're glad you came along. We hope you find this discussion as provocative and inspiring as the books themselves. Want to join the great conversation? Stay tuned. You've come to the right place. Well, well, welcome back to Bibliophiles, everyone. Adam Andrews with you and flying solo this time. I am without the Center for Lit crew altogether. But don't worry, because you're in good hands. I've done this kind of thing before. I'm operating without a net, but you have nothing to fear. It's Bibliophiles special edition this time around. And I am thrilled as I can be to announce a brand new kind of content for our podcast. We are having an author interview from outside of the formal domain of fiction. Professor Tracy McKenzie of Wheaton College is here with me today to discuss his recent book, We the Fallen People, The Founders and the Future of American Democracy, out just this year from InterVarsity Press. And I am as thrilled as I can be to be discussing this book live with the author for two reasons. Number one, as you may know, my own history, academically speaking, is in the field of history. And it gets more specific than that. I actually took classes from this very man, Professor Tracy McKenzie himself. We were a teacher-student relationship back in the early days and have since become good friends. And I am just as proud as I can be to help announce his new book to the world. So, Professor McKenzie, welcome to Bibliophiles. It's really good to have you.
Adam, it's just a delight. I've been looking forward to this. I can't wait to talk with you.
Good, good. Well, I want to say a word or two about why the discussion of We the Fallen People, the Founders and the Future of American Democracy belongs on Bibliophiles. It's obviously a work of history, as all of your books are. But I just, before we get into the topic and get into the book itself, I just want to mention that it is a work that's relevant, I think, to anyone who is an assiduous reader, to anyone who's got a literary bent, to a Bibliophiles listener, in other words. And for a reason I think will become clear as we go along, there's a work of literature kind of at the heart of your analysis in this book that I think is worth paying attention to. But also, the subject of the book kind of deals with our attitude toward elements of the past, which is a category that all great literature belongs in. When we read a great work of fiction, we are not only reading a work of art that's timeless and eternal, but also we're reading, as it were, a voice from the past, speaking to us of past concerns and past issues and a past situation. And so our attitude toward the past, our techniques for reading it properly, for looking back correctly into the past, are really important for the reading project, as well as for the project of history generally. So I think for that reason, at least, it's going to be really fun to kind of poke you on that issue. The other reason, however, is that I grew up taking classes from you, talking about American history with you, and it's really fun to see this one come out and to have it be as relevant to our own day and age as I think it is. So with that, by way of apology, I unreservedly launch into a discussion of a work of history here on Bibliophiles. But let's do this, if you don't mind. Let's start by having you give us just a quick summary of the kind of the argument, the thesis, the subject matter of We the Fallen People.
Yeah, sure. We the Fallen People is really aimed at helping Christians or challenging Christians to think about the assumptions about human nature that we take with us when we go into the public square, you know, when we think politically and engage politically in our surroundings. My starting point is an insight that I take from C.S. Lewis. It's simple, but it's really profound. Lewis wrote right after the Second World War that there are really only two reasons to believe in democracy to begin with. One is because you have faith in human nature, and the other is because you don't have any faith in human nature. Lewis said, you know, to elaborate, I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, on the one hand, you might think men and women are so naturally good and so naturally wise that they not only deserve a voice, but that the public good really suffers when they don't have a voice. On the other hand, he said, you might think men and women are so selfish by nature. He actually said wicked by nature, that none of us and no small group of us can be trusted to exercise power over our fellows. In other words, then, there are only those two options. We believe in democracy because we have faith in human nature, because we don't. The thesis of the book is essentially that Americans have embraced democracy for the wrong reasons, for the reasons that aren't biblically supported. And I try to help us see that by taking readers back to a time when most political thinkers had an understanding of human nature very, very foreign from our own. That would be the period of the American Revolution and the creation of our Constitution. We then leapfrog to what I would consider really the birth of modern democracy as we might recognize it, the period of the presidency of Andrew Jackson. But this is still a time when these values that we take for granted today are new and raw and controversial. This is what I think history allows us to do. It takes us outside of our own particular frame of reference, gives us a different vantage point to look upon our own day and age and to see it more clearly. And that's what I hope readers of We the Fallen People take away from it. And then in the end, to decide what, if anything, they need to change in order to bring a testimony into the public sphere that is consistent with God's revelation and God honoring.
That sounds like a tall order. I think, however, you have accomplished it. Having read through the book myself, I've been moved and challenged, and some of my own assumptions about about American democracy, about the history of that idea since the founding of the Republic, have really been challenged, and I've come to think differently. And I expect that from a great work of literature and indeed from a great work of history as well. But let me jump into a specific scene from an early part of the book, actually the beginning of part two of your book, describing an interlude between the young Andrew Jackson and an opponent in a duel. You describe how Andrew Jackson has been defeated early in his career in a legal case, and his opponent, the other lawyer, has had the temerity to ridicule his case in some way. And so Jackson challenges him to satisfaction, which is understood to mean with pistols drawn. And you describe this scene. You mention a detail that many readers may be familiar with, which is that this wasn't Jackson's last duel. And it also wasn't the only duel where he intentionally missed his opponent. He actually carried bullets around in his body for most of his life as the result of shooting people in similar situations. But you jump off from that scene to describe Jackson's particular attitude toward opponents, political and moral and otherwise. And I want you to describe that for just a minute, but I want to notice that this is in a part of your analysis that you call the Great Reversal. And I wonder if you could tell us what you mean by the Great Reversal and how that fits into Jackson's early personality.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. So, the thrust or the heart of my conclusions historically is that the ways in which Americans have justified democracy have changed dramatically since the founding. And that change occurred a very long time ago, almost two centuries ago. It's not really recent. So the framers of the Constitution, generalizing broadly here, would have started with an understanding of human nature is basically selfish. They thought that men and women were capable of great acts, single acts of courage or generosity or self-sacrifice, but our default motive is self-interested. We please ourselves, we wish to rule ourselves, and we're often willing to pursue self-interest even when it hurts other people. And so our Constitution was really framed with that in mind. And all of those checks and balances and the separation of powers among the different branches of government, all those things we learn about a little bit in junior high, I guess, they only make sense when we understand them as flowing out of this view of human nature. The best sort of example of that mindset that I mentioned in the book is actually a little anecdote about a member of the Massachusetts State Constitution Ratification Convention, which takes place in 1788. There's this little known tavern keeper who stands up in a debate about the proposed Constitution, and he's concerned that it's given the central government too much power. He fears that will lead to oppression in some sense of the people. And when there's pushback and other delegates sort of push him to defend his view, he basically says, you know, gentlemen, I suspect my own heart. And so, yes, I will suspect my rulers. And I was so struck by that. His skepticism of government isn't based on the idea that he is righteous and, you know, the folks in Washington are all corrupt. He knows his own heart. Mm-hmm. And because he knows his own heart, he is skeptical about giving power to others. To me, that's the mindset that actually gave birth to our Constitution. Then let's telescope forward to Andrew Jackson and to that anecdote that you were referring to. We have to imagine a young Andrew Jackson who would have come in at probably close to between 6'1 and 6'2, but only weighed about 135 pounds when he was a young adult. He was absolutely rail thin. He had a shock of red hair, as I put it, that had a mind of its own that he was never really able to control throughout his adult life. He had almost no formal education whatsoever. Mm. And yet, at the age of 21, when he loses a court case to a man in his mid-40s who had been a hero of the American Revolution in North Carolina, who had held state offices, had been a widely respected attorney and jurist, when he loses to that man and his ego is bruised, he immediately challenges him to a duel. And I just argue that this is so emblematic of the way that Andrew Jackson faced life. He was supremely sensitive to slight. And as I argue, never encountered anyone who disagreed with him for honorable reasons. anyone who disagreed with him had some sort of nefarious scheme, some sort of underlying agenda. No one would disagree with Andrew Jackson if they were honorable because he was always right. Mm. I'm not exaggerating here, although it may sound like it, but I have read, I would guess, a little over 4,000 pages of his personal correspondence, meaning that he himself authored or dictated to assistants. And I have never, on a single occasion, encountered an instance in which he admitted that he had been wrong about something.
Wow.
And so, you know, if the earlier view was to say, I suspect my heart, and that informs the way I think about politics, yeah. Jackson is the great reversal. He never doubted his heart. And I argue that the Democratic mindset that has been predominant for about the past two centuries in the United States is exactly along those lines. Modern American democracy does not suspect its own heart.
Mm. Well, I was going to follow up that with a question about the critique you offer of Jackson, which goes on from here. And you take us through all of the major sort of eras of Jackson's career, from Indian removal to the bank war, to all of those things. And your critique, if I could just quickly give a reaction, gets more and more pointed as we go along. Jackson does not come out smelling like a rose, as we might put it in the Andrews family or on bibliophiles. So the modern application then, the modern day application of this critique of Jackson, I think you alluded to it just now, it has something to do with the fact that the idea of democracy that came of age in the age of Jackson is the one we still operate on. Would that be fair?
I think that's entirely true. I mean, you know, we can see all kinds of differences between democracy in the 21st century and two centuries ago. We know that, you know, the electorate has expanded. Women now are enfranchised. People of color are enfranchised. Many other differences we could name. But when it comes to the way that we think about human nature, Jacksonian democracy is 21st century democracy and vice versa. This very positive understanding of human nature, of the people, is intrinsically virtuous, collectively wise, meaning their collective decisions are reliably just. This is something that unifies our time and theirs. And I think Jackson is right in the center of that. One of the things I try to suggest to readers when they think through that is that as Jackson tells them repeatedly that they are, as he will put it, virtuous, incorruptible, beyond corruption, he is training them to believe, just as he, that the only people who will disagree with them are scoundrels. That is to say, there is no honorable reason to disagree. And Jackson consistently sort of plants that idea in the mind of the electorate, even to the point of telling them that they cannot trust not only the other party in government, but his own party. He really suggests that really the only person to be trusted in Washington is Jackson himself. And so what eventually he will begin to do is to take stronger and stronger actions. Jackson really does more in a proportional sense to increase the power of the presidency, I think, than any other American president. And we need to acknowledge what it is that he is doing. He is concentrating power, which the framers of the Constitution would have always said is dangerous because human nature is fallen. Power is always a threat to liberty. But Jackson is telling the voters, no, that's not true. It's only when our enemies exercise power. I really think that's where we are today. Mm. Whatever Christians may think about the dangers of power, we're really primarily concerned about power in the hands of the other guy.
In the wrong hands, yeah.
We're pretty sure, as I put it in the book, we know power can't be entrusted to our teenage kids or to Nazis, but at least to us, we're quite happy to clothe ourselves with power because we're sure that we will use it justly, which, again, great reversal is the exact opposite, I think, of the mindset that pervaded the late 18th century.
Mm. We in the literary world, we live in light of moments in the past that have changed or altered the way people think about art. We talk a lot about William Wordsworth and his lyrical ballads, where he suggests a brand new way of thinking about poetry and a brand new source of the poetic imagination and a brand new way of seeing the world that involves people looking inward to see truth inside rather than looking outward beyond the hills to see some objective truth out there. So we talk all the time about still living in the shadow of a change that happened 200 years ago. You're saying the same kind of thing with respect to Jackson's career, that that he came along or was at the cusp of a movement that came along that has, in the shadow of which we still live and think and talk and do politics today. Fair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way that I characterize Jackson is as the nation's first populist president. Mm. That's a term that your audience has heard, I'm sure, in recent times. We think of populism as something that not only is a major factor in American politics now, but in much of Europe, in parts of Central and South America, it really is a worldwide phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And what populism basically does is offer a story for making sense of our lives. It says that there is an ongoing struggle between the people and some enemies to their welfare. They may be, wealthy individuals or industrialists. They might be people from outside the country. They might be immigrants. In the run-up to the Civil War, the threat to the people was the slave power, some politicians would have said. So it's identifying a threat to the people and then allowing the politician to proclaim him or herself the champion of the people, the defender of the people. And the really interesting thing here is that if we went back to the time of the revolutionary generation, they would have said that someone who wishes to present the challenges in that way as a struggle between the people and their enemy, and then present themselves as the defender of the people, they had a name for that. They called it a demagogue.
I thought you were going to say that.
a demagogue was a scoundrel, someone who clearly had an ambitious agenda and wanted to erode confidence in the government for their own selfish purposes. By the time of Andrew Jackson, we didn't call it a demagogue. We called it a champion, a hero. And Jackson really sort of established a mode that is so familiar to us today. It really just sort of becomes white noise. Mm. We expect candidates to tell us that we're wise and good. We expect candidates to tell us that if the other side wins, we're in a boatload of trouble. And this just what we take for granted. But, what I try to argue in We the Fallen People is that there are theological truths being proclaimed here about the human condition. And we need to be sure that we're thinking deeply about what those messages are and be very confident that we believe they're in conformity with God's revealed truth.
Mm. I want to talk about that in just a minute. But before we go on to it, I got to get back and not leave out the other leg of this stool, which maybe is the big link to the world of books and literature, as we like to talk about it on Bibliophiles, which is Alexis de Tocqueville, because Andrew Jackson is one of the two historical moments or historical personages that you really dive into. And the other one is the Frenchman Tocqueville and his Democracy in America. How is it that you combine analysis of these two things in We the Fallen People?
Well, I think that by looking at both of them, it enables us to sort of take not one, but sort of two passes at the early stages of American democracy. In looking at Jackson's administration specifically, we're looking at, you know, actual campaigns and campaign rhetoric. We're looking at concrete policy issues like the work of the National Bank or the presence of Native Americans within the United States. And we're sort of seeing that play out in concrete ways. What Tocqueville brings, I think, though, among many things, is an effort to try to search for universal principles, because he wasn't just interested in democracy in America. He was interested in democracy. He believed that the world, or at least the West, was undergoing a dramatic paradigm shift that was unprecedented, that an old way of governing societies was giving way inevitably to this experiment in self-government. And he wanted to figure out what that meant for the future. He wanted to know what it meant for his homeland of France. He wanted to know what it meant for the rest of the Western world. So what Tocqueville does is to take what he observes, and he tries to look for underlying principles that he believes are broadly transferable, so that he's no longer just talking about democracy in North America in the 1830s. He's trying to help us think about democracy as a phenomenon across centuries and across space. And so they're just approaching it in two different ways. One is more sort of abstract and theoretical. One is very concrete and specific. And I think by doing both, I hope, helps us to fit the pieces together and make sense of what we're observing just more effectively than we would otherwise.
What does Tocqueville say about the prospects for democracy on into the future? What are his, does he look to the future darkly? Is he optimistic? How can you summarize for us what you say a couple times in the course of the book that democracy in America is long and difficult? Several times you say, well, what would Tocqueville say about this? And then there's this rhetorical pause and you say, well, it's complicated, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah, I say at one point, nobody ever reads Democracy in America for the humorous anecdotes. They're not there. And it is a convoluted book. I think to answer your question as quickly as I can, I just have to say, first of all, that to Tocqueville, democracy meant one and one thing primarily. It meant a way by which a society would translate the will of the majority into policy. And so that's sort of his simple idea. Anything that the majority favors is democratic. And if that is implemented, then we say democracy is being executed in that instance. So when Tocqueville thought about the future, he was very certain that democracy would prevail. And what he meant by that, he said, we're not going to continue to have a kind of feudalistic society. Monarchy is going by the wayside. True systematic rule by aristocrats is going by the wayside. We're going to have popular forms of government going forward. Democracy will prevail. But lest we think that that's too optimistic, we have to understand that he believed that democracy could be liberal, by which he meant promoting human liberty and dignity. He also thought it could be authoritarian. It could be very oppressive. It could promote prosperity. It could promote misery. It could promote civilization. It could promote barbarism. And in fact, he says all these things in the very last sentence of the book. So the question to Tocqueville was never, will democracy prevail? The question was, what kind of democracy will prevail? And here he, in his own words, says he has both hopes and fears. One of the things that Tocqueville says that we often remember him for is that the majority itself can be tyrannical, just like any king or dictator. So that's something always to be a source of fear and concern. The optimistic side of that is that it doesn't have to be. He was not fatalistic in thinking that a selfish people have to ultimately promote an unjust system. But he would tell us that this is always a feasible outcome. That is to say, we need to always be open to the possibility that our democracy can be the cause of injustice as much as the solution to injustice. And so from across the centuries, he's reminding us that a democracy that promotes a fair and just society is never to be taken for granted and is always just, you know, maybe one generation away from dissipation.
Mm. Which brings me to my next question, having to do with the title of your book. You insert a word uninvited into a familiar phrase, "We the People." You insert the word "fallen" into the title. And obviously "fallen" has, you know, it's laden, the term is laden with religious significance, as you, as a Christian historian, openly acknowledge. Let's talk about that, the reasons for putting that word in the title. We've alluded to, obviously, to this idea already, but let me put it this way. How are we fallen with respect to politics and maybe even history, in your view?
Yeah. So, you know, when we're talking about the fall in theological terms, we mean that human beings come into the world with certain propensities that shape their behavior naturally. Augustine would have boiled them down basically to the idea that we want to rule ourselves. We resist lawful authority over it. We're recalcitrant, as he might have said. And we have all kinds of illicit desires. Our desires aren't godly. They are illicit. So we want to rule ourselves and please ourselves. And when it comes to our political behavior, I think what that means, what the framers of the Constitution would have said it meant, is that we gauge policies based on what's in it for us. And isn't that what we do? I mean, sort of naturally.
I was sitting here thinking, as you said, that
going to affect me. I mean, you know, I mean, how is that going to affect my take-home pay? And we just naturally assume that. But the framers would have said, wait a minute, stop and think. You're saying that the wisdom of any policy has nothing to do with the general welfare or the common good, but with your own well-being. So to say that we are fallen is to say that we're selfish, that we place our own welfare above that of others. And when it comes to politics, it means that we're actually not too disturbed about the prospect of a policy that might harm others as long as it benefits us. And so I think the framers of the Constitution took that in mind in a way that we have largely forgotten.
So a major principle of reading great literature from the Center for Lit perspective in the world of bibliophiles is an attitude of humility before the text, the desire to understand as clearly as possible what the author had in mind when he put the text together and created it initially. We may call it the hermeneutics of recovery, I guess they say in the graduate school, right? We're looking back to an old text and saying, what was in his mind when he made this? Is there any trace of that perspective in your mind when you look back to the age of the founders on this issue of human nature?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of what I do in the early chapters of the book is to try as carefully as possible to recapture what the framers understood about human nature and to try to trace how that then translated into the concrete decisions that they had to make at Philadelphia about the structure of the government. I don't argue in the book that the framers at the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention were all devout Orthodox Christians. I really think that's very hard to prove one way or the other. They didn't talk about their personal faith a great deal, but they talked to anyone who would listen about what motivated human behavior. Mm-hmm. For the simple reason, I think they believed that it was probably the single most important issue that they had to reckon with to structure a government that would last, a government that wasn't sort of logically related to how men and women actually are motivated, wasn't likely to be very successful. So yes, I mean, a lot of what I'm trying to do is to recapture the original mindset of the framers, knowing that it's not possible to do that perfectly. But they left us quite a few markers about what they believed. And then I really challenge readers to be open to the possibility that they saw things that we don't see anymore. Mm. And here I so resonate with how you describe your audience on Bibliophiles. One of my favorite quotes from a fellow historian is the quote that says, at its best, the study of history can be a conversation with the dead about what we should value and how we should live. Mm-hmm. And so I really challenge readers to be open to the possibility that there's something they're going to encounter in this earlier age that will totally change the way that they understand their present world. Mm.
How much of that is, let me put this the question this way, how necessary is your Christianity to carrying on that transaction, that conversation effectively? Or maybe a better way to put it is, what role does Christianity play in looking back in the past and doing right by it?
Well, that's a great question. You'd think it'd be one that I would have wrestled with for a long time. I'm not sure that I yet have an answer. Is it absolutely indispensable to doing what I did? I would say probably not. Certainly there are historians who have asked some similar questions, I suppose, from the revolutionary generation. I would say, on the other hand, that my faith absolutely, I think, is central to why I wanted to pose the question. One of the things that I think my Christian convictions and my understanding of God's revealed word tell me is that it is utterly unreasonable to think of the human story as one of progressive elevation toward more and more approximation of perfect understanding and truth. I think the whole biblical concept to honor age, one of my favorite verses actually is from the book of Job, and it's actually from one of Job's counselors, and we all know that they weren't very good counselors. But one of the things that Bildad tells Job in Job chapter 7, he says to Job, he says, you know, you're trying to understand what's happened to you, and he says, you need to consult your fathers, and then ask their fathers. And why? He says, because we were born yesterday and know nothing. And so I think, you know, Christian principles teach us to have the opposite of what Lewis called chronological snobbery. We should be humble, which makes us at the same time open to the possibility that there are previous times that see so much that our world doesn't see. Mm. And that is so countercultural to say that. But I do think in my case, it grows directly out of what I have learned from God's word.
Mm. Well, it's one thing to say, to come down on one side or the other of the question, how indispensable is Christianity to doing history properly? It's quite another thing to say, what obligations does the Christian have when looking back into history? You and I have talked for years about this issue of thinking Christianly about history, about the past generally, which makes literary analysis fall under that rubric as well. What does it mean to think Christianly about Andrew Jackson and Alexis de Tocqueville and things past?
Well, when I talk about thinking Christianly, I have a couple of things in mind. First of all, I don't want to pass over the basic verb there, just to think. The part of the exhortation to think Christianly is to think. And so much of, I think, of our engagement with the world today, and I'm not just talking about Christians or any particular group, but American culture generally, so much of our what passes for our public discourse is really driven by our identity of whichever, you know, group or affiliation that defines for us who we are. And we just let that drive our conversations, which means we almost rarely ever are open to changing our mind or do change our mind. So I think we start with that exhortation to think. But then when we say thinking Christianly, you know, I think in the broadest sense, it means bringing God's revealed truth in a conscious and systematic way to things that are not always explicitly described in Scripture. So, for example, the Scripture doesn't talk very much about how to live in a democracy, right, for the reason that there were none at the time. And so we're not going to find a verse that tells us exactly what we're supposed to do in a given situation in a democratic society, but we can find all kinds of principles that are applicable. They require wisdom, and Christians may still disagree, But we need to know what are the principles that are sort of our foundation. And when it comes to thinking Christianly about democracy, I'm of the opinion that there's no more important principles, biblical truths to bring to bear than what the Bible teaches us about the human condition. Because what is democracy but a decision to allow a broad involvement in self-government? And so I think the ideas theologically of original sin, the idea that we all come into the world with these propensities to self-rule and pleasing ourselves, and then also imago Dei, the idea that we also are all bearers of the image of God. As Lewis would put it, we will never encounter a mere mortal. Right. And so those two things, both our fallen natures, but also our intrinsic preciousness as image bearers, I think looking for ways very consciously to say, what do those require of me in the way that I think about my role in the public square?
Mm. Yeah. We talk a lot about the about acts of charity in the mind and heart toward dead authors, mm-hmm. Treating their books as salvos in a conversation, but treating the authors as at a disadvantage because they're no longer speaking. And so we must deal with them charitably and give them the benefit of the doubt, as it were, and find ways to make their words clear in the way that we think they meant them. Is there some analogy to dead politicians?
Yeah, I would say there is, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I tell my students generally is that part of what the historian is called to is to love the dead. You know, yeah. we take the biblical injunction to love our neighbor, and we broaden that to include those who have gone before, who are no longer alive. And so in that respect, loving these political figures that have gone before is sort of a subset of that larger obligation. Mm. But, you know, we live in a time where our culture generally speaks with the greatest sort of arrogant dismissiveness about dead white males and, you know, those sorts of things. So we live in a culture where all of the inertia is in the opposite direction. Mm. And so being open to the idea that these individuals who have gone before still have something to say to us, mm-hmm. is a kind of, I think, almost a spiritual discipline. It's something that we purpose to practice. Mm-hmm. It's not going to come natural. I don't think it comes natural to us by any means.
That reminds me of one of the last two questions I want to ask you today. This has to do with the role of parents and teachers in guiding students into considering the past and the evidence of the past correctly. I mean, what advice would you give to a homeschool parent or a classroom teacher who's got a group of kids in front of him or her, and the subject on the table is, what do we think about what came before? What do we think about our own history, our own heritage? What advice would you give as a historian?
Oh, gosh, that is so hard. It's a great question, and it's a challenge. But, you know, we live in a society, I'm not the only one who's thought of this. It's not my idea originally at all, but figures from the past are almost not real to us.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a culture where the reminders of those who have gone before us are just not very prevalent anymore. So we don't walk out of our churches and see a cemetery, you know, next to the church, for example. We don't typically grow up in a community where, you know, our great grandparents lived, and we know where these other generations had walked and lived. And so the past can be really sort of imaginary. So I think the first challenge, and I hate to, you know, just condense it to the cliche, but finding a way to make the past come alive, where I think literature has a great advantage often over nonfiction historical writing, so that we imaginatively can begin to experience other worlds and believe that those worlds might connect in some way, sort of overlap with our own. That's not the same thing. You know, when we think about how we educate children in terms of history, that's not the same thing necessarily as memorizing a lot of historical facts about a time period, as much as it is imaginatively creating possibility, opening up space that individuals might want to explore further. And so that's a pretty wishy-washy answer, but I actually think you know, the heart is what fuels our intellectual curiosity more often than not. I think that's the case.
I'd agree.
And so I think finding ways to capture the imagination about the past is the first step. And when it's accomplished, can be so fruitful for further development.
So you would maybe put that on higher on the priority list than coverage even.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know.
Talk to me about that for just a minute. No, not at all.
I don't know if that's heretical or not, but you know, we actually schooled all of our children at home, and my wife and I would talk about what you do with children, at, you know, this age or that age, historically. And I feel almost all the way through one's education, those instances where we can ignite interest and fuel the imagination and generate a desire for more engagement are worth, you know, a hundred of the coverages of particular factoids that we think or have been trained to think are important. Just to be very honest, I think what we're about is educating lifelong learners. And the most important threshold that can ever be crossed is simply the one that says there is something of value here. And if coverage works against the ability to capture the student's imagination, then it's not a good thing at all.
Right.
And if we spend the entire year, you know, on one subject and convert individuals into lifelong enthusiasts for history, they may not do well on the AP exam, but the AP exam is not a good monitor of historical consciousness or wisdom. We just got to turn loose of that.
Behold, Bibliophiles listeners, I didn't say it. We got somebody else tooting my very own horn. That is wonderful news. Thank you. Listen, back to the book. Before we adjourn, I want to dive back in just for one moment into the last part, section 5 of We the Fallen People, which you entitle Lessons for Today. And you even mention in some specificity modern political situations, even current political situations. And the section is gripping reading, but it comes across as a warning and an exhortation. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could send us off with kind of a summary of what you would see as the warning in that last part and the exhortation.
Yeah, that's really good. Good question. Important question. I have to take the moment to encourage your audience. I would love for Christians who are wanting to see American democracy flourish to pick up the book and think about some of the things that I would ask them to think about. So yes, warning and exhortation. The warning, without being sort of fatalistic or exaggerating our plight, I am convinced that American democracy is both very fragile and in a very, very vulnerable state right now. And I say that as a historian of the American Civil War. I've spent most of my adult career teaching and writing on that period. We're not on the verge of something like the American Civil War. And yet, I'm convinced that Americans are more polarized than they have been since the American Civil War. And I think that we see signs of the dysfunctional state of our American democracy all around us. So that's the warning. We must never presume that American democracy is inevitably going to flourish and succeed. The exhortation is that Americans can begin to take steps that will move us toward a healthier and better functioning democracy. I did not write We the Fallen People as a manual for how to solve the American political challenge right now. I did not write it as a manual for how any political party might flourish, or much less how Christians might regain political power. But I did write it believing that the church has a great deal of latitude about the kind of witness that we give to the world in this moment. And so my real exhortation to readers is, and I give some examples of what this might look like, but to think of ways that taking very seriously our own fallenness, not the fallenness around us, not the fallenness of the other party, but our own fallenness, how taking that seriously might reshape the way that we engage in the public sphere. Mm-hmm. And without going into more specifics than that, I do believe that this is a paradigm shift that would rock our worlds if we really acted on it. And whatever it might do for our political system, I think it would revivify and refine our testimony, our witness to our neighbors.
I'm just reminded of Job's declaration at the climax of that great work of biblical literature that you alluded to a minute ago. I put my hand over my mouth. I have spoken what I did not know, and I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. That's a pretty safe ground to stand on, it would seem, whether reading the old classics or looking back into history and applying the lessons we find there to our current lives in this world.
Couldn't said it better. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Professor McKenzie, my old friend, thank you so much for being with us and with the Bibliophiles audience today. We really appreciate you joining me.
Adam, it was an absolute pleasure, as it always is, to talk with you.
The book is We, the Fallen People from InterVarsity Press, just came out. Tracy McKenzie, the author, has been with us today. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I had a good enough time, but I'm going to look for other authors of current books to have on the show and see if we can't get a new tradition going. But if you enjoyed it, give us a comment below. Come by centerforlit.com and see what we're doing for readers, teachers, homeschoolers, and thinkers about books and ideas. And until we meet again on a future episode, happy reading.
Bibliophiles is a production of the Center for Lit podcast network. Find new episodes each month on the web at centerforlit.com, where you'll discover dozens of resources to equip and inspire you to participate in the great conversation, including the Pelican Society, a membership program for folks who love the Center for Lit approach to all things literary. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, happy reading, everyone.